The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Nick Chater. Nick is a professor of behavioral science at the Warwick Business School. He has over 200 publications and has won 4 national awards for psychological research. He has served as associate editor for the Journals of Cognitive Science, Psychological Review, and Psychological Science. He was selected a Fellow of the Cognitive Science Society in 2010 and a Fellow of the British Academy in 2012. He has served on the advisory board of the Cabinet Office's Behavioral Insight Team, popularly known as the Nudge Unit. He has a new book, The Mind is Flat: The Illusion of Mental Depth and the Improvised Mind. Nick Chater, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So a lot of the work we do at Second City is training business groups to teach them improvisational exercises to improve their ability to communicate and collaborate and think in a more divergent manner. So just last week, we were in New Orleans working with 200 senior female financial executives, and we had them play this game called One Word Story. In this game, you have 5 or 6 people come together, and they need to tell a story, but they tell it one word at a time among the whole group. And like most groups, they initially found the exercise way more difficult than they expected because, as we note, it requires individuals to surrender their own desired storytelling, among other things. And I thought of this when you were writing about gaze contingent eye tracking. So I want you to talk a little bit about that testing and what it uncovered and how it fits into the thesis of your book.
Yeah, very interesting. So let me start a little bit with One Word Story, actually,
yeah.
Which I think is itself extremely remarkable. The fact that it's possible to fairly rapidly, with a bit of practice and a bit of warm-up, to produce even sentences, let alone stories, one word at a time, where you're, the control is passing from person to person, is an amazing tribute to human improvisational abilities. Mm. We're much better when we let go, when we loosen up, when we allow ourselves to be. We're much better at improvising than we imagine.
Right.
And we, in order to play a game like One Word Story, you have to respond incredibly quickly to the story as it's unfolding. You have to think, where is this going? Where is this sentence going? Do I need a noun or a verb? What would make sense in context? And pop in a word, and then a few hops later, it's back to you, and you need to pop in another word. And of course, every time you're jumping from word to word, you're not just thinking creatively when you're thinking about the word you're going to say. You're doing the same thing when you're thinking about what everybody else is going to say. You're surprised. Sometimes what other people say is unexpected. Sometimes it's what you imagined. You're continually having to readjust the train of thought, the direction of the story based on what you're hearing. So that continual cycle of prediction, improvisation, evaluation is something that game picks up extremely well. And we are remarkable wizards at this. And I think one thing that's very interesting about that is it reveals just how fluent our ability to generate explanations, stories, verbal descriptions is. We are remarkably good at coming up with stuff that makes sense, stuff that is relatively coherent, extremely naturally and fluently. And that itself is an interesting metaphor for how we think about our own minds, because often, when we're, for example, confronted with a question, a query, an interruption, why did you do this, or why did you think that, or what was your justification for all of these things, in one-word story spirit, we can come up with an explanation, and out pops an answer. And if we're interrupted or pushed again, we'll pop out with another answer and another answer.
Mm-hmm.
And that very fluency can give us the impression when we're thinking about ourselves. So instead of creating a story, instead of this being a creative act, we can think, no, I'm not creating anything. I'm just reporting what's in my head.
Right.
You ask me why I did something, I report. And you ask me again, and I report again. And that, I think, is a very interesting illusion.
Mm-hmm.
But now, let me turn to gaze contingent power tracking, because you're spot on that this is a very interesting connection. So first of all, to explain to the listeners what the mysterious gaze contingent eye tracking experiment is. So here's how it works. It's possible, in fact, it has been possible since the 1970s, to monitor live fairly accurately where your eyes are looking. And in fact, as the technology's got better, it's got more accurate, but it's also got more, as it were, freeform. So once upon a time, you had to essentially be clamped into position, looking straight ahead, with unable to move while the eye tracker tracked your eye. Now you can move around much more fluently, and the technology is able to cope with that. But in any case, eye tracking is quite old technology, and from fairly early on, as I say, in the 1970s, people started to have the interesting idea that as your eye is moving, we can change what you're going to see. Now, you might think immediately, well, that's not going to work, because if I keep changing the display on the computer screen as you move your eye, it's going to seem strange. It's going to be immediately obvious to me that something's changing. But in fact, that's not the case. And one reason for that is when you move your eyes, you're actually essentially totally blind for a short period of time. So our eyes move around in short hops. When they are at a stationary point, then we can take in visual information. But when they're actually in the process of hopping, which will be several times a second,
mm-hmm.
we're effectively blind. So if during one of those hops you change the image, you work out where the eye has landed, you put up a new image, we are remarkably not able to discern any changes occurred. Now, here's the really cool thing, the really interesting thing. If you get people to, for example, read a text, then what you can do is you can see their eye hopping pretty much word to word to word. Now, where there are short words, people will sometimes jump over. And when people get confused or puzzled, they may hop back. But on the whole, you hop word to word to word, aside from very short words like the as and the thus and so on. And what the gaze contingent eye tracking technology allows you to do, and this was work originally done in Keith Rayner's lab in the US, is to give people a little window of proper letters, the letters in the text they're reading. So roughly a window of about 15 is about right. So you have, if you're reading left to right, you have about 5 to the left and about 10 to the right. The brain's looking a little more forwards than backwards. And all the other letters on the screen are X's, or in fact Latin, or anything in fact. Now, the remarkable thing about this is that you can read perfectly happily when all you're actually seeing is 15 letters of text and everything else is X's, as long as the 15 letters of text are where you are looking.
Right.
And as you look somewhere new, the letters pop from being X's into being the text you would expect. And when you look again somewhere else, the letters appear. So that means that if someone's looking over your shoulder, they see a page full of X's or a line full of X's, and they see a little window of text hopping around, because they can see that this thing is a little sort of tiny patch of proper text. But for you, the reader, you all you see is normal text. Everything's fine. So the strange thing is that when we look at a piece of text, we have the sense that it's all there for us. There are words everywhere.
Yeah.
But in fact, that can't be right.
This was hilarious because I was reading this literally in your book while I am assuming I am seeing the whole page. And then I'm reflecting back. I reflected back on another improv exercise that we do, which is called Last Word, where we have two people have a conversation, but what each person has to do is begin their response with the last word that the other person said, which forces you to listen to the end of the sentence, which is people discover, oh, I don't normally do that. I am hopping ahead. I am moving forward. And in that, you are losing so much. And you, I think that there's an inference inside there that I think that's interesting. But also, you're tying it into this much bigger idea, which involves sort of our idea about an inner world to the mind, the sort of what I would call the central problem of your book. And it's that there's this common sense story, and you say it needs to be abandoned, not patched up. This is a pretty radical idea, that the idea that maybe this idea around an inner world is a mirage.
Yeah, that's right. So I think starting in a way with improvisation is a good place to start.
Mm-hmm.
When we're looking at a page of text, we have the sense that all the words are visible to us. We can see them all. And I think one reason for that is that whenever we think to ourselves, I wonder what's in what's at the top of the line at the top of the page. You can wonder that, and as soon as you wonder it, you can answer the question. Because your eye, in fact, will flick up and see that word.
Sure.
And then you think, oh, well, actually, what's the page number? Oh, yeah, I can see that too, look, 47. Now, in fact, we know your eye can't be picking that up, not just from gaze contingent eye tracking experiments, but because the eye is extremely poor at discriminating visual detail, terrible, outside about a 2-degree angle where you're directly looking. So things like color and detail are very, 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 very poor outside the little spotlight. So we know that you can't be picking that information up. Indeed, you certainly aren't, because of the clever gaze contingent eye tracking experiments. But you have the sense that it's all there. And the reason you have the sense that it's all there is as soon as you ask yourself the question, out pops the answer. Now, then if you consider, not perception, but imagine looking inside your own mind, you have the sense there that you have an enormous range of beliefs and motives and desires and preferences. And the reason we have that sense, which is just the same as our sense of the enormous visual richness of the world around us, or the existence of all the words on the page, in fact, they're all simultaneously loaded up into our minds. I think the reason we have that illusion is the same reason. But as soon as I ask myself, well, why do I believe? Why is the cup on the table not falling off? And I think, oh, well, that's because it's kind of got a rough bottom and it's kind of a flat surface. And you say, oh, well, why does roughness make things not move around? And I think, oh, yeah, well, friction. And you can ask me many more questions and I'll keep producing answers.
Mm-hmm.
And the sense can be that, yeah, this is all preloaded. I've got all this stuff. I've got a kind of theory of all my thoughts, all my preferences, all my desires, all my motives. They're all in there. And instead of improvising an answer, cooking up an answer when you ask the question but not before,
mm-hmm.
I have the illusion that the answers are, as it were, pre-prepared.
Hmm.
Now, one reason that can't be the whole story, I think really is not any part of the story, really, is that the kind of answers we give, as you'd expect if you were improvising, but not if you were, as it were, reading off from the inner world,
right.
The answers that we'd give tend to be very self-contradictory. So you can ask me the same question in different ways at different times, and I will give you an answer. And it'll sound jolly convincing, but because I just made this up, it won't fit together with the answer I gave you before. So, for example, thinking about improvised stories,
mm-hmm.
One thing that's very hard about creating improvised stories, or indeed stories of any kind, is being consistent.
Yeah.
You say something, you have a character in one place, then you go to another place, and then there's a kind of complicated chain of interactions between people. And if you're not careful, before you know it, something... Yeah, the pieces just don't quite line up. People are ending up in situations or having interactions which just can't quite be right. And we find ourselves picking apart and books and films and TV shows all the time, thinking, hey, that doesn't quite hang together. Now, of course, reality hangs together. Reality is sort of inevitably consistent. But as soon as we're trying to create stories, the inconsistencies pop up all over the place. And in our explanations of our own thoughts, we're wildly inconsistent, crazily inconsistent, essentially all the time. Then let me give you one example for your listeners of the kind of way in which you can see this inconsistency in action. In fact, perhaps I'll give you a nice vivid example from going back to the I think pretty much the 60s. This is work by, originated by Michael Gazzaniga, looking at patients with split brains. So these are people who, because they'd had serious epilepsy, had had the corpus callosum, which is the bundle of fibers that connects the left and right hemisphere of your brain to each other. They've had that severed, and that's to stop the epilepsy from moving from one half of the brain to the other, which can be a treatment for certain kinds of severe epilepsy. And now I think it's a much rarer treatment. Now, the remarkable thing is that you think that having your two hemispheres of your brain separated would lead to all kinds of problems.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it turns out remarkably, people can live relatively normal lives and work and engage in quite complicated conversations and complicated activities pretty well, which is in itself amazing. But you do find that there are various very telling things that they do, which indicate that the brain, the different halves of the brain, are clearly not communicating, which of course they can't be. So the kind of case of interest is a case where you present some information to the left half of the brain, and you can do that because you can present it on the right visual field. So the information on the right side flips across to the left half of your brain. And the left half of your brain, for most of us, is the primary area concerned with language. So your left hemisphere is the speaking half. And then you can also present information to the right half of the brain, and that will go to the left visual field, and that will go to the right half of the brain. This is kind of strange crossover wiring.
Mm-hmm.
So you can send some information by putting it on the right half of the screen to the left brain, the linguistic brain. And you can put other information, feed that across to the right non-linguistic brain. And then you can, and indeed, you can also get the person concerned to answer questions with that manually with their hands. And there's also crossover wiring here, so it's a bit mind-boggling. But if I give you an image on the right half of the visual field, it flips across to the left half of the brain, and then if you answer with your right hand, that's also controlled by the left half of the brain. That's also sort of crossover wiring. So now what's interesting here is that I can, if I, as it were, send a question about the right visual field, and I send it across the left half of the brain, and the left half of the brain answers with the right hand, then that's, you know, that, and then I ask the left half of the brain to explain, why did you do that? That's all going to be fine, because the left half of the brain saw the image, decided on the action, moved the right hand, and of course the left half of the brain knows about language. But if, on the other hand, I send a question to the right half of the brain, the non-linguistic half, and it has to answer that question with the left hand, which is not controlled by the linguistic brain, mm-hmm. then it will answer the question. It'll do something. It'll respond. But then if I ask the person, well, why did you do that? They have, of course, no idea. Because when I ask them the question, mm-hmm. they have to respond with the linguistic half of the brain, and that's the left half.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's going to happen now? So what's going to happen if I give some information to the right half of the brain. So, for example, I show it. I think a famous example is I show it a picture of a range of pictures, and it has to pick one out. Then the right half of the brain will say, "Yeah, I think that's the one I want to pick." If I ask the left half of the brain why you picked it, it miraculously comes up with a story. It does essentially something a bit like one word improvisation. It cooks up a story. It says, "Oh yes, the reason you picked it was blah." But in fact, it can't be right because the left half of the brain has no understanding of what the right half of the brain does. And often it will come up with very, very nice stories. So I think, and this is from memory, so it may not be exactly right, but I think one nice example is show a picture of the word bell,
mm-hmm.
the right half of the brain, and you show it some pictures, and the right half of the brain points to a picture of a bell. Great, all looking good. And then you say, why did you do that? And then the left half of the brain sees the hand it doesn't control pointing at a bell and thinks, ah, yes, well, I heard a bell on campus as I came in today.
Mm.
So that's why I picked it. But that's completely wrong. Right? The reason you picked it is that you just matched a word and a picture. But the left half is this kind of confabulatory, describing, explaining machine. And it will explain stuff that it did do, stuff that it didn't do, stuff that there's nothing about, and it'll do it fluently and happily and with no sense that this is a more difficult task than normal. And that's a clue, I think. I think this is what Michael Gazanik would also say. It's a clue that the left half of the brain is always engaged in this activity. It hasn't got a kind of direct line into the causes of our behavior. It's always monitoring our behavior, seeing what we're doing, and thinking, what's going on there? Why am I doing that? And producing a story.
So the idea that human beings make up, we're constantly making up stories to justify things, that's not science has established that, I think. That's pretty well...
Yeah, I think that's not a radical idea.
Right? No, that's not a radical idea.
I don't know.
But you're taking it, I think, a step further, correct? And there's a lot of people... I was reading a lot of people arguing about your book because you are making the leap here that this idea of a hidden depth in our mind that we're drawing from just doesn't exist.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, that does sound like a rather radical claim. And I think, in a way, it is. But I think it's less unintuitive than one might think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if we imagine the state of psychology before Freud, no one had really ever had the idea that alongside the apparent flow of experience that we are aware of, there might be, underneath that, in some sort of separate system, perhaps, another flow of thought, or perhaps a much larger, deeper world of thoughts, which are running along autonomously,
mm-hmm.
But we're not aware of. So the idea of unconscious thought is quite a recent idea, the idea there could even be such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, once you've had the idea of unconscious thought, one can start to use it to explain almost anything. Any time you think, why do I choose one thing rather than another? Oh, I'm not very sure. Ah, well, there must have been an unconscious influence that affected me. I bet that was my unconscious. And of course, then you can perhaps even tell a story about, oh yeah, now I think about it, I bet it was that experience I had as a child or whatever it may be. You can produce a story. So it becomes a sort of very fertile ground for producing explanations of behavior, and we can become very attached to that metaphor. But I think a better metaphor is thinking that rather than there being, another intuition we have, I think, which is very much a post-Freudian idea, is that the unconscious is, to some degree, hidden from us.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just that it's a matter of inattention, we're not looking very closely at the sources of our behavior, it's that there's actually maybe even direct defensive mechanisms which are protecting the unconscious thoughts from breaking out into consciousness. So there's this sort of idea that, for example, it might be useful from a therapeutic point of view to reveal the unconscious explanation underlying behavior, and that might solve psychological problems, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that's a very misleading way to think. But the brain is, roughly speaking, a serial processing system, by which I mean it really does one thing at a time, or at least any chunk of brain does one thing at a time. So it's true that the brain can chew and walk and speak at the same time to some degree, because the systems involved in those activities are fairly independent, and there are certain very repetitive activities which can be carried out by very specific brain processes. Only one extreme example would be something like controlling your heart rate or breathing. But complicated things which require sort of high-level thought and concentration, these tend to engage really large amounts of the brain, pretty much the frontal lobes, all the areas concerned with control, large areas of the rest of the brain. Often if you're doing something which involves, for example, something like tying your shoelaces, there's a lot of visual information, there's a lot of motor control, large areas of the brain are in action here. Now, that means that if you're doing a complicated, not highly practiced, unfamiliar activity of a reasonable level of complexity, pretty much the whole, or at least vast tracts of your brain are involved in that.
Yeah.
So your brain cannot be thinking about anything else, because each chunk of the brain, that's part of the network, is only really able to do one thing. And the whole thing, pretty much the whole thing, is engaged. And in fact, this is why attention is so serial. It's why we find that when we're, for example, searching, if we're looking at one of those pictures where you have two versions of the same image and you have to look for differences, you used to get in newspapers, and you think, of course, that'll be easier. I just look at one picture, I look at the other one, surely the differences are apparent. But in fact, you have to attend very closely and notice a tiny difference here, a tiny difference there, a tiny difference here.
Hmm.
You can only load up a tiny amount of information at once. And that's a sort of and indeed we can only recognize one word at once, as we spoke about earlier, really.
Mm-hmm.
Digital eye tracking, you can recognize more or less one face at a time. So this sort of one thing at a time principle means that the whole idea that there's a kind of unconscious realm of thinking lurking around in the background is an illusion. Now, on the other hand, that's not to say that our past thoughts don't affect our future thoughts. So the fact of the matter is, of course, every time I do something new, I do it by adapting and evolving and working from things I've thought and done before. Mm-hmm. So it's not that when I do every new thing I do from scratch. I'm being continually influenced by memories I have of past interactions, which won't be memories I necessarily access. But that's not some sort of conscious, mysterious world. It's like it's more that the present flow of consciousness, conscious experience, is being influenced by my whole history of past conscious experiences and behaviors.
It was interesting. When I first read Thinking Fast and Slow, it struck me that what Kahneman was talking about was what we teach in improvisation, right? We're constantly shifting between our system one and system two. So you have your fast brain and your slow brain. So you have to listen completely, but you're drawing on all your past knowledge to improvise presently. And we talk a lot about being present. And it is what you're talking about, I know, can be unsettling for people because it feels like you're saying there's nothing there, but that's not what you're saying. I mean, we're still, there's tradition, right? We're still drawing from that sort of very rich tradition. Yeah. And you're also not denying a cognitive bias here and there, because that's also part of our makeup, correct?
No, that's absolutely right. So the tradition point, I think, is a very a very powerful one. So, for example, if you imagine improvisation in the context of music, so jazz improvising, mm-hmm. This is an extremely complicated activity done extremely rapidly and extremely sophisticated when you analyze it in detail what's going on there. But of course, it would be a mistake, at least from my perspective, it would be a mistake to think that what's going on is reflection of some sort of unconscious understanding of the music, which is somehow disconnected from the moment, the actual the flow of experience at the moment of the improvisation. But what is happening is that you are taking snippets of improvisation that you've done in the past and you've heard in the past from other people, mm-hmm. and you're transforming those into the present. So, in fact, jazz improvisations are quite well modeled, as I understand it, as sort of extremely flexible patchworks of past improvisations. And I think comedy improvisation is the same.
Yep.
People who are good at improvisations of all kinds, and they're not creating something out of nothing. They're creating something by transformation mm-hmm. of all the somethings they thought before.
Right.
But the things they're transforming are just the kind of thing they're creating now. It's like you're a coral reef where each new polyp is growing and building on all the polyps before to create a complex, rich structure. But it's not that there's a framework underneath the polyps which is somehow guiding them. It's just one little polyp at a time, one little tiny creature building on the next. And so I think, yes, the idea that people are traditions is to sort of see everything we do as traditions of improvisation. But of course, those traditions can become very, very stable in many ways. Many of the things we do become very stable. Sometimes that's very good. So we're reliable. We all see the same thing. We don't have to think about what we wear or what we eat for breakfast. That's all fine. Obviously, those traditions can potentially become too stable. So we can become locked into patterns that we need to actively break out of. Now, connecting it with thinking fast and slow.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Kahneman's view there, and I think it's very nicely expressed in his title, is not really, although he uses this metaphor, it's not really that there are two systems exactly.
Mm-hmm.
There's really one system, which either is operating fast or operating slowly. And the way I would put that in my framework is to say, at any given moment, you can only, with your serial one-thing-at-a-time brain, you can only focus your attention on one problem.
Yeah.
Let me recognize this word, let me interpret this face, whatever it may be. But you can also, so in some sense, that's the fast part.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you can either decide to take the output of the immediate, the immediate rapid processor and say, yep, end of story, I've seen this person, I don't like the look of them, I don't trust them, I'm walking away, or
mm-hmm.
engaging or whatever it may be. Or you can reflect. So you can engage in further similar processes, but nonetheless more of them, in which you say, oh, hang on, maybe I'm misjudging this this book or this person or this sentence or whatever it may be. Let me step back. And the reason I might be misjudging this is because of this, that, and the other. So it's a whole sort of domain of reflective thought that we're allowing ourselves to step back from our immediate, this conclusion we immediately jump to, and just reflect and ponder and cross-check. And of course, each bit of cross-checking, each bit of pondering is no more foolproof than the first thought. It's the cross-checking that's helpful. And I think that's the thing that allows us to catch ourselves, to have some chance of unpicking some of the biases that our very fast system produces.
I'm curious, I mean, you had to know that you were going to get some pushback when you were publishing this book, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And indeed, and I have not read every review, but the, you know, five or six that I picked up was a nice even split among people who were I'm annoying people now talking about this, and I count myself as being one of those people. And other people were like, great read, don't buy it. So did that bring you pause, or was that a kind of thing that in the, your field that you're like, well, let's throw it out there and see what happens?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of what I expected to be the case. I think, I think you're right, that people will be, I mean, I hope everybody will feel there's interesting stuff to think about here. Mm-hmm. I think that I failed if that's not the case. But I think inevitably, this is a sufficiently heretical and radical position with respect to our common sense understanding of ourselves, mm-hmm. that inevitably there's going to be an uncomfortable perspective. And I think actually it's quite interesting how deeply embedded in our minds the sort of post-Freudian and Freudian view just has become. We feel that to be rich, complex human beings, we don't just need a flow of thought and a tradition and the history we are and all the different skills we have and how they're layered and built on each other. We feel, no, not just that. I've also got a hinterland, a sort of inner world, which is, I'm not quite sure what's in it because it's somewhat opaque to me, but it's rich and complicated and it evades understanding. And that mysterious world is somehow essential to me as a complex being. And I think you would expect people. Some people are going to find that an uncomfortable message, but I think it's also quite a liberating message.
Yeah.
The pitch I really want to give people, and perhaps if you were to start the book and not read too far, you might think, "Oh, this is going to be a an uncomfortable read. I think I might stop." Mm-hmm. But because of that sense of the dissonance with one's hoped for or imagined sort of rich in itself. But I think actually the liberation aspect is quite real. Because if you do think that there's an unconscious self or an unconscious set of processes which are guiding and shaping your behavior, of which you know very little or nothing, then that means you're imprisoned by those. You can't control them. There's an inner forces which are shaping and pulling you around in ways that you have no understanding of and no ability to control. And I think actually when one considers oneself as an improviser, as a storyteller, a creator of one's own life, moment by moment, then that gives us more space and more opportunity to think of ourselves as active creators of our own future, essentially thinking of ourselves as characters of our own creation. Now, of course, that's not to say that we are creators of ourselves with the complete liberty to turn ourselves into anything we want, and we can't do that any more than we have the amateur saxophonist can turn himself by sheer force of effort into Charlie Parker.
Right.
And it would be wonderful if that were possible, but it isn't possible. On the other hand, if you're not Charlie Parker, you can, by dint of hard work and study and repetition and continual careful, thoughtful improvisation, you can get a little closer.
Yeah, well, we're unreliable narrators of our own stories, I think is the idea. I want to ask you about your SAN story, but before we do that, I want to follow up on this because, you know, as I'm reading this book, I'm so excited because, you know, the work we're doing right now at Second City at the Center for Decision Research, Chicago Booth, is tying together these worlds of studying improvisation with behavioral science and creating games. And I love this idea of art and science coming together. And as I'm reading your book, I'm like, you're not completely bought in. And in fact, in many ways, think that art can be a danger to science. I've picked up on that correctly, right?
Yeah, I mean, overall, I think I'm actually very interested in the relationship between art and science, and I think one of the things that's most revealing about human cognition is the kind of artistic productions that we create.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact, for example, that we can produce improvised music and poetry and comedy, and that we can create characters out of thin air and understand those characters out of thin air merely by sending words to each other, often very few, that's astonishing, and it's telling us something really deep. I think a lot of understanding of human behavior in psychology is rather underplayed.
Hmm.
The spectacular innovation, creativity, improvisational skill that we have, which is so evident as soon as you think about any kind of artistic activity. And also, actually, relatedly, the enormous metaphorical sophistication we have.
Yeah.
How it's incredibly easy for us to see any kind of strange object as a face, or a highly distorted pattern as a human body. There are astounding metaphorical abilities. Are kind of completely, that they are the playthings of cartoonists and movie makers and artists. So, I think of art as an amazing window, actually, into sort of psychological richness.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if one thought of the kind of explanations one sees within art, or within, say, literature in particular, as themselves, as it were, the sort of ground truth about humanity, that would be a mistake. What you're seeing in literature, and what you're seeing in our own everyday explanations of our own behavior and the people around us in conversation and so on, is you're seeing sophisticated story creation, but that's all we ever have. What you're not seeing is, as it were, a telescope being pointed inward. So it's not that the novelists, say, has not just a perception of the world around them, but they have the ability to turn the lens within and to see in more precise detail than the rest of us the contents of their own mind. I think that's the wrong picture. Actually, what they're doing is they're observing the world around them, the people around them. They're transforming, changing, distilling some of that, and we, with our creative powers, are then turning that back into something,
right,
something fascinating, interesting, and somehow rich and deep. But it's not really, yes, it's the I think, at least in some conceptions of what literature is about, it's sort of the deep insight into the human condition, which somehow views that as a voyage of inner discovery. And I think that's a misleading picture.
Yeah. I could talk to you forever. However, we are going to end on asking you for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, we teach, and we do this with our beginning students, is we say literally, don't say no. Don't say yes, but you have to say yes and. It is our nudge towards the understanding that the default behavior is to do nothing or to say no. But we ask our guests if they have a yes and story, a time in their life when they normally would have said no, but instead they said yes and.
Yeah. Now this is a very interesting one. So I suppose for me, the thing that really that is, I suppose, most powerful and most relevant for me is the thing that took me into psychology in the first place. So I had a bunch of I was studying maths and then left philosophy as an undergraduate, and I had the option of doing a psychology external module. And I really did have that sense of, this is just some fluffy, strange, foreign, probably not very rigorous subject. So why don't I just stick with the rigorous world that I'm used to, the world of maths and philosophy, and sort of a clear-cut sort of logical, rational argument. And I tipped myself, for some reason I don't quite understand, thinking, But why not? Why not? What is in this world? And with a slight sense, which is terribly, it's slightly embarrassing to admit now, The slight sense of, well, I bet it's all a bit fluffy, and I'm probably making a mistake here, but I bet you, you know, I'll be able to sort this out with a few, you know, sort of mathematical equations and a bit of, sort of philosophical sophistication. I'll be able to make some, you know, good sense of this stuff, where the psychologists have been floundering. And of course, once I started doing psychology, once I said yes and started studying it, I suddenly thought, wow, this guy, these guys are really smart and really interesting, and they've got all kinds of great stuff I had no idea about. And so I sort of tipped myself into a new world, and I'm so glad I did.
That's great. Nick Chater, thank you for coming on the show.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, I've been working in a home.